wild boars with horns, golden lapdogs, spider moths, leaf men, and anything else he can dream up.
Spider moths? Leaf men? Fenolia looked at Farid in alarm, but Farid didn't seem to notice.
Orpheus wants to talk to you, he whispered to Mo. About the white women. Please do meet him. Maybe you know something that could help him to bring Dustfinger back.
Maggie saw the pity in Mo's face. He didn't believe Dustfinger would ever come back any more than she did.
Nonsense, he said, as his hand instinctively went to the place where Mortola had wounded him. I don't know anything. Anything more than everyone knows.
The guards had let the butcher pass, and one of them was staring at Mo again. The basilisk painted by Farid on the stones was still burning on the castle walls. Mo turned his back on the soldier.
Listen, he whispered to Meggie, I ought not to have brought you here. Suppose you stay with Farid while I go to see Balbulus. He can take you to Roxanne's, and I'll meet you and Risa there.
Farid put his arm around Meggie's shoulders.
Yes, you go. I'll look after her.
But Meggie pushed his arm roughly away. She didn't like the idea of Mo leaving her behind, although she had to admit she'd have been only too happy to stay with Farid. She'd missed his face so much.
Look after me? You don't have to look after me!
She snapped at him more sharply than she had intended. Being in love made you so stupid.
She's right about that. No one has to look after Meggie.
Mo gently took the horse's reins from her hand.
Now that I come to think of it, she's looked after me more often than the other way around. I'll soon be back, he told her, I promise. And not a word to your mother, all right?
Meggie just nodded.
Stop looking at me so anxiously,
Mo whispered in a conspiratorial tone.
Don't the songs say the blue jay hardly ever does anything without his beautiful daughter? So I'm much less of a suspicious character without you.
Yes, but the songs are lying, Meggie whispered back. The blue jay doesn't have a daughter at all. He's not my father. He's a robber.
Mo looked at her for a long moment. Then he kissed her on the forehead, as if obliterating what she had said, and went slowly toward the castle with Fenolio. Meggie never took her eyes off him as he reached the guards and stopped. In his black clothes, he really did look like a stranger, the bookbinder from a foreign land who had come all this way to see the famous Balbulus's pictures and give them proper clothes to wear at last. Who cared that he'd also become a robber on his long journey? Farid took Meggie's hand as soon as Mo had turned his back to them.
Your father's as brave as a lion, he whispered to her. But a little crazy, too, if you ask me. If I were the Blue Jay, I'd never go through that gate. Certainly not to see a few books. You don't understand, replied Meggie quietly. He wouldn't do it for anything except the books.
She was wrong about that, but she wouldn't know about it until later. The soldiers let the writer and the bookbinder pass. Mo looked back at Meggie once more before he disappeared through the great gateway, with its pointed iron portcullis. Ever since the milksop had come to the castle, it was lowered as soon as darkness fell, or whenever an alarm bell rang inside the building. Meggie had heard the sound once, and she instinctively expected to hear it again as Mo disappeared inside those mighty walls. The ringing of bells, the rattle of chains as the portcullis dropped, the sound of the iron spikes meeting the ground.
Meggie,
Farid put one hand under her chin and turned her face to his.
You must believe me. I'd have come to see you ages ago. But Orpheus makes me work hard all day, and at night I steal out to Roxanne's farm. I know she goes to the place where she's hidden Dustfinger almost every night. But she always catches me before I can follow her. Her stupid goose lets me bribe it with raisin bread, but if the Linketto in her stable doesn't bite me, then Gwyn gives me away. Roxanne even lets him into the house now, though she always used to throw stones at him before. What was he going on about? She didn't want to talk about Dustfinger or Gwyn. If you really missed me, she kept thinking, then why didn't you come to see me at least once, instead of going to Roxanne's? Just once?
There was only one answer, because he hadn't been missing her half as much as she'd missed him. He loved Dustfinger more than her, He would always love Dustfinger, even now, when he was dead. All the same, she let him kiss her, only a few paces from where the boy was still in the pillory with fire elves on his skin. Don't tell me you can get used to such sights. Meggie didn't see Sootbird until he had reached the guards.
What is it?
Farid asked as she stared over his shoulder.
Ah, Sootbird, yes. He's always going in and out of the castle. Whenever I see him, I feel I could slit his throat. We must warn Mo.
The guards let the fire eater pass through like an old acquaintance. Meggie took a step toward them, but Farid kept her back.
Where do you think you're going? Don't worry, he won't see your father. The castle is large, and Silvertongue is going to see Balbulus. Sootbird won't lose his way and end up there too, you can bet. He has three lovers among the court ladies. He's off to see them. If Jacopo doesn't nab him first, he has to perform for the boy twice a day, and he's still a terrible fire-eater in spite of all they say about it. Miserable informer. I really wonder why the Black Prince hasn't killed him yet, or your father. Why are you looking at me like that?
He added, seeing Maggie's horrified expression.
Silvertongue killed Basta, didn't he? Not that I saw it.
Farid glanced quickly down, as he always did in speaking of the hours when he had been dead. Meggie stared at the castle gates. She thought she could hear Mo's voice talking about Sootbird.
And if he does, last time he saw me I was half dead, and another encounter will be the worse for him.
The Blue Jay.
Stop thinking of him by that name, Meggie thought. Stop it!
Come on. Farid took her hand.
Silvertongue said I was to take you to Roxanne. Won't she just be glad to see me?
But I expect she'll put on a friendly act if you're there, too.
No.
Meggie freed her hand from his, good as it felt to be holding hands with him again at last.
I'm staying here. I'm staying right here until Mo comes out again.
Farid sighed and rolled his eyes, but he knew her well enough not to argue with her.
Oh, wonderful, he said, lowering his voice. If I know Silvertongue, he's sure to spend forever looking at those wretched books. So at least let me kiss you, or the guards will soon be wondering why we're still standing around.
Chapter 7. A Dangerous Visit. Humble. Humility and servility, he wasn't good at it. Did you ever notice that in the other world, Mortimer? He asked himself. Bow your head. Don't stand too straight. Let them look down on you, even if you're taller than they are. Act as if you think it is perfectly natural for them to rule and everyone else to work. It was so hard.
Ah, you're the bookbinder Balbulus is expecting, one of the guards had said, glancing at his black clothes. What was all that with the boy just now? Don't you like our pillory?
Head lower, Mortimer. Go on, pretend to be afraid. Forget your anger, forget the boy and his whimpering. It won't happen again.
Exactly. He comes from far away,
Fenolia was quick to add. He has yet to get used to our new governor's rule, but if you'll allow us, Balbulus can be very impatient. Then he had bowed and hastily drew Mo on with him. Umbra Castle. It was difficult not to forget everything else when he stepped into the great courtyard. He remembered so many of the scenes from Fenolia's book set here.
Heavens above, that was a close thing, whispered Fenolia as they led the horse to the stables. I don't want to have to remind you again. You're here as a bookbinder. Play the Blue Jay just once more and you're a dead man. Damn it, Mortimer, I ought never to have agreed to bring you here. Look at all those soldiers. It's like being in the castle of night.
Oh, no, I assure you there's a difference, Mo replied quietly, trying not to look up at the heads impaled on pikes that adorned the walls. Two belonged to a couple of the Black Prince's men, although he wouldn't have recognized them if the strong man hadn't told him about their fate. Although I didn't imagine the castle quite like this, from your original description in Inkheart, he whispered to Fenolio.
You're telling me? Fenolio murmured. First Cosimo had it all rebuilt, now the milksop's leaving his mark on the place. He's had the gold mockers' nests torn down, and look at all the shacks they've put up to hoard their loot. I wonder if the other heads noticed yet how little of it ever reaches the castle of night. If he has,
His brother-in-law will soon be in trouble. Yes, the milksop is pretty brazen about it. Mo lowered his head as a couple of grooms came toward them. Even they were armed. His knife wouldn't be much use if anyone actually did recognize him. We stopped a few convoys intended for the Castle of Night, he continued quietly when they had passed, and the contents of the chests always proved rather disappointing. Fenelio stared at him.
You're really doing it?
Doing what? The old man looked nervously around, but no one seemed to be taking any notice of them.
Well, all the things they sing about, he whispered. I mean, most of the songs are poor stuff, badly written, but the Blue Jay is still my character, so... What does it feel like? What does it feel like, playing him?
A maid carried two slaughtered geese past them. The bird's blood dripped onto the courtyard paving stones. Mo turned his head away.
Playing? Is that what it still feels like to you? Some kind of game?
His reply sounded touchier than he had intended. Sometimes he'd really have given anything to read the thoughts in Fenolio's head. And who knew? Maybe he would indeed read them someday in black and white, and find himself there on the page, with words spun around him like a fly caught in an old spider's web.
I admit it's turned into a dangerous game, but I'm really glad you took the part. Because wasn't I right? This world needs the blue...
Mo interrupted Fenolio and put his fingers to his lips. A troop of soldiers passed them, and Fenolio bit back the name he had first written down on a piece of parchment not so long ago. But the smile with which he watched the soldiers pass was the smile of a man who had hid an explosive device in his enemy's house and was enjoying mingling with them, knowing they had no idea he had planted that bomb. Wicked old man. Mo realized that the inner castle didn't look as Fenolio had described it anymore either. He quietly repeated the words he had once read.
The laughing prince's wife had laid out the garden because she was tired of the grey stones all around her. She planted flowers from foreign lands, and when they came into bloom, they made her dream of distant seas, strange cities, and mountains where dragons lived. She allowed gold-breasted birds to breed, birds that perched in the trees like feathered fruits, and planted a seedling from the wayless wood, a tree with leaves that could talk to the moon.
Fenolio looked at him in surprise.
Oh, I know your book by heart, said Mo. Have you forgotten how often I read aloud from it after your words had swallowed up my wife?
The gold-breasted birds had left the inner courtyard too. The milksop statue was reflected in a stone basin, and if the tree that talked to the moon ever existed, then it had been felled. Dogpens stood where there had once been a garden, and the new Lord of Ombra's hounds pressed their noses to the silvered wire fencing.
It's a long time since this was your story, old man, thought Mo, as he and Fenolio walked toward the inner castle.
But then, who was telling it now? Orpheus, maybe? Or had the Adderhead taken over as narrator, using blood and iron instead of pen and ink?
Tullio took them to Balbulus. Tullio, the furry-faced servant, said in Fenolio's book to be the offspring of a brownie father and a moss woman mother.
How are you?
Fenolio asked him, as Tullio led them down the corridors, as if it had ever interested him how his creations were doing. Tullio answered with a shrug of his shoulders.
They hunt me, he said, his voice barely audible. Our new master's friends, and he has a lot of them. They chase me along the passages and shut me in with the hounds. But Violante protects me. She protects me, even though her son is one of the worst of them.
Her son? Mo asked.
Yes, didn't Meggy tell you about him? Fenolio whispered back. Jacopo, a real little devil. His grandfather in miniature. Although he's getting to look more like his father every day. Not that he ever shed a tear for Cosimo, far from it. They say he daubed Cosimo's bust in the crypt with Balbulus's paints. And in the evenings, he sits beside the milksop or on Sootbird's lap, instead of keeping his mother company. It's said he even spies on her for his grandfather, the Adderhead.
Mo had read nothing in Fenolio's book about the door, outside which Tullio finally stopped, rather breathless after climbing so many steep flights of stairs. He instinctively put out his hand to stroke the letters that covered it.
"They're so beautiful, Mo,"
Meggy had murmured, as the two of them sat high in their prison in the Castle of Night,
intertwined as if someone had written them on the wood in liquid silver.
Tullio raised his small furry fist and knocked. The voice calling them in could belong to no one but Balbulus. Cold, self-satisfied, arrogant. The words Meggy had used to describe the best illuminator in this world were not nice ones. Tullio stood on tiptoe, took hold of the door handle, and then let go of it again in alarm.
"Tullio!"
The voice echoing up the staircase sounded very young, but it seemed used to giving orders.
"Where are you, Tullio? You must come and hold the torches for Sootbird."
"Jacopo." Tullio breathed the word as if it were the name of an infectious illness. He ducked and instinctively tried to shelter behind Mo's back. A boy of perhaps 6 or 7 came running upstairs. Mo had never seen Cosimo the Fair. The milksop had had all his statues smashed, but Battista still had a few coins with his picture on them. A face almost too beautiful to be real. That was how everyone described him. His son had obviously inherited that beauty, although as yet it was only developing on his still round, childish face. But it was not an endearing face. The boy's eyes were watchful, and his mouth was as sullen as an old man's. His black tunic had an embroidered pattern showing his grandfather's emblematic adder with its flickering tongue. And even his belt was set with silver snakes, but around his neck dangled a silver nose, the piper's trademark. Fenolio cast Mo a glance of alarm and stood in front of him, as if that would hide him from the boy. "You must come and hold the torches for Sootbird. Now what, Mo?" He instinctively glanced down the stairs, but Jacopo had come alone, and this castle was large. His hand went to his belt all the same.
"Who's that?"
Only the defiance in the clear voice sounded like a little boy's. Jacopo was breathing heavily from all that stair climbing.
He's the new bookbinder, my prince," replied Fenolio, bowing. "I'm sure you remember how often Balbulus has complained of the clumsiness of our local bookbinders."
"And this one's better?"
Jacopo folded his little arms.
"He doesn't look like a bookbinder. Bookbinders are old and all pale because they sit indoors the whole time."
"Oh, we go out now and then too," replied Mo. "We go out to buy the best leather and new stamps, good knives, or to dry parchment in the sun if it's damp."
He found it difficult to feel afraid of the boy, although he had heard so much that was bad about him. Cosimo's son reminded him of a boy he had known at school, who was unlucky enough to be the headmaster's son. He used to stalk around the schoolyard like a copy of his father, and he was afraid of everything and everyone in the world. "That's all very well, Mortimer," Mo told himself, "but he was only a headmaster's son. This is the grandson of the Adderhead, so take care." Jacopo frowned and looked disapprovingly at him. Obviously, he didn't like the fact that Mo was so much taller than he was.
"You didn't bow. You have to bow to me."
Mo felt Fenolio's warning glance and bowed his head.
"My prince."
It was difficult. He would rather have chased Jacopo along the castle corridors in fun, the way he used to chase Meggy in Eleanor's house, just to see if the child in him would emerge, carefully hidden as it was, behind his grandfather's mannerisms. Jacopo acknowledged his bow with a magnanimous nod, and Mo bowed his head again so that the boy wouldn't see his smile.
"My grandfather is having trouble with a book," remarked Jacopo in his arrogant voice. "A lot of trouble. Perhaps you can help him."
Trouble with a book. Mo felt his heart miss a beat. In his mind's eye, he saw the book before him again, felt the paper between his fingers, all those blank pages.
"My grandfather has had lots of bookbinders hanged already because of that book."
Jacopo looked at Mo as if working out the size of the noose to fit his neck.
"He even had one flayed because the man had promised he could make the book better. Will you try all the same? But you'd have to ride to the Castle of Night with me so that my grandfather can see I was the one who found you, not the milksop."
Mo managed to get out of answering that, as the door covered with letters opened and a man came out, an expression of annoyance on his face.
"What's all this?" he snapped at Tullio. "First there's the knock, but no one comes in. Then so much talk that my brush slips. So as you all clearly have not come to see me, I would be greatly obliged if you'd continue your conversation somewhere else. There are more than enough rooms in this castle where no real work is done."
Balbulus. Meggy had described him very well. The slight lisp, the short nose and plump cheeks, the dark brown hair already receding from his forehead, although he was still quite a young man. An illuminator. And from what Mo had seen of his work, one of the best there had ever been, in either this world or his own. Mo forgot Jacopo and Fenolio. He forgot the pillory and the boy in it, the soldiers down in the courtyard, and even Sootbird. All he wanted was to go through that door. Even the glimpse of the workshop that he caught over Balbulus's shoulder made his heart beat as fast as a schoolboy's. He felt the same excitement as when he first held a book illustrated by Balbulus in his hand, when he was a prisoner threatened with death in the Castle of Night. This man's work had made him forget all that. Letters flowing as easily as if there were no more natural occupation for the human hand than writing. And then the pictures, living, breathing parchment.
"I'll talk to people where and when I like. I'm the Adderhead's grandson."
Jacopo's voice was shrill.
"I'm going to tell my uncle how impertinent you've been again. I'm going to tell him this minute. I'll say he ought to take all your brushes away from you."
With one last glance at Balbulus, he turned.
"Come on, Tullio, or I'll shut you in with the hounds."
The little servant went to Jacopo's side, head hunched between his shoulders, and the Adderhead's grandson inspected Mo again from head to foot, before turning and hurrying down the stairs again. Suddenly just a child, after all, in a hurry to see a show.
"We ought to get out, Mortimer," Fenolio whispered to him. "You should never have come to this place. Sootbird is here. It's not good, not good at all."
But Balbulus was already impatiently beckoning the new bookbinder into his workshop. What did Mo care about Sootbird? He could think of nothing but what awaited him behind the door with the silver letters all over it. He had spent so many hours of his life poring over the art of illumination, bending close to stained pages until his back ached, following every brushstroke with a magnifying glass and wondering how such marvels could be captured on parchment. All the tiny faces, all the fantastic creatures, landscapes, flowers, miniature dragons, insects, so real that they seemed to be crawling off the pages. Letters as artfully entwined as if their lines had begun to grow only on that parchment. Was all that waiting for him on the desks in there? Maybe. But Balbulus stood in front of his work as if he were its guardian, and his eyes were so expressionless that Mo wondered how a man who bent so cold a gaze on the world could paint such pictures, pictures so full of strength and fire.
"Inkweaver."
Balbulus nodded to Fenolia with a look that seemed to sum him up, the unshaven chin, the bloodshot eyes, the weariness in the old man's heart. "And what," Mo wondered, "will he see in me?"
"So you're the bookbinder."
Balbulus inspected him as thoroughly as if he planned to capture him on parchment.
"Fenolio tells me truly wonderful things about your skill."
"Oh, does he?"
Mo couldn't help sounding distracted. He wanted to see those pictures at long last, but once again the illuminator barred his way as if by chance. What did this mean?
"Let me see your work," thought Mo. "You ought to feel flattered that I've risked my neck to come here for its sake."
Good heavens, those brushes really were incredibly fine. And then there were the paints. Fenolio dug a warning elbow into his ribs, and Mo reluctantly tore himself away from the sight of all these wonders and looked into Balbulus's expressionless eyes.
"I'm sorry, yes, I'm a bookbinder, and I am sure you will want to see a sample of my work. I didn't have particularly good materials available, but..."
He put his hand under the cloak that Battista had made. Stealing so much black fabric couldn't have been easy, but Balbulus shook his head.
"You don't have to show me any evidence of what you can do,"
he said, never taking his eyes off Mo. "Taddeo, the librarian in the Castle of Night, has told me at length how impressively you proved your abilities there."
Lost. He was lost. Mo sensed Fenolio's appalled glance on him.
"Yes, look at me," he thought. "Are the words reckless idiot written as black as ink on my forehead?"
However, Balbulus smiled.
His smile was as hard to fathom as his eyes.
"Yes, Taddeo hath told me about you at length."
Meggy had given a good imitation of the way his tongue touched his teeth as he spoke.
"Usually he is rather a reserved man, but he positively sung your praises to me in writing. After all, there aren't many of your trade who can bind death itself in a book, are there?"
Fendolio gripped his arm so hard that Mo could feel the old man's fear. Did he think they could simply turn and walk out of the door? A guard would surely have been posted outside some time ago. And even if not, there were soldiers waiting at the bottom of the stairs. How quickly you got used to the way they could appear at any moment, armed with the power to take a man away, imprison him, or kill him with impunity. How Balbulus's colors glowed, vermilion, sienna, burnt umber, how beautiful they were. Beauty that had lured him into a trap. Most birds were trapped with bread and a few tasty seeds, but the blue jay could be caught by words and pictures.
"I really don't know what you're talking about, highly esteemed Balbulus," stammered Fenolio.
His fingers were still clutching Mo's arm.
"The librarian at the Castle of Night? No, no, Mortimer's never worked on the other side of the forest. He comes from the north. Yes, that's it."
What a terrible liar the old man was. You'd have thought someone who made up stories could tell better lies. However that might be, Mo himself was no good at lying either. So he kept quiet, silently cursing his curiosity, his impatience, his recklessness, while Balbulus went on staring at him. What had made him think he could simply discard the part he was expected to play in this world by putting on a few black clothes? What had made him think he could go back to being Mortimer the Bookbinder for a few hours here in Umbra Castle?
"Oh, be quiet, Inkweaver,"
Balbulus snapped at Fenolio.
"Just how much of a fool do you think I am?
Of course I knew who he was the moment you mentioned him, a true master of his art. Isn't that how you put it? Words can be very treacherous, as you really should know by now."
Fenolio did not reply. Mo felt for the knife that the Black Prince had given him when they set out from Mount Adder. "From now on, you must always have it with you," the prince had told him, "even when you lie down to sleep." Mo had followed his advice, but what use would a knife be to him here? He'd be dead before he reached the foot of the stairs. For all he knew, maybe Jacopo himself had immediately realized who was standing in front of him and had raised the alarm too. "Come quick, the blue jay's flown into the cage of his own free will." "I'm sorry, Meggy," thought Mo. "Your father is an idiot. You rescued him from the Castle of Night, only for him to get himself captured in another castle. Why hadn't he listened to her when she saw Sootbird in the marketplace?" Had Fenolio ever written a song about the blue jay's fear? The fear didn't come when he had to fight, not then. It came when he thought of fetters, chains, and dungeons, and desperation behind barred doors. Like now, he tasted fear on his tongue, felt it in his guts and his knees. At least an illuminator's workshop is the right place for a bookbinder to die, he thought. But the blue jay was back now, cursing the bookbinder for being so reckless.
"Do you know what particularly impressed Taddeo?"
Balbulus flicked a little powdered paint off his sleeve. Yellow as pollen, it clung to the dark blue velvet.
"Your hands. He thought it astonishing that hands that knew so much about killing could treat the pages of a book with such care."
"And you do have beautiful hands. Look at mine now."
Balbulus spread his fingers and examined them with distaste.
"A peasant's hands, large and coarse. All the same, would you like to see what they can do?"
And at last, he stood aside and waved them over,
like a conjurer raising the curtain on his show. Fenolio tried to hold Mo back, but if he'd fallen into the trap, then he meant at least to taste the bait that would cost him his life. There they were, illuminated pages, even better than those he had seen in the Castle of Night. Balbulus had adorned one of them with nothing but his own initial. The B spread right across the parchment, clad in gold and dark green, and sheltering a nest full of fire elves. On the page beside it, flowers and leaves twined around a picture hardly the size of a playing card. Mo followed the tendrils with his eyes, discovered seed heads, fire elves, strange fruits, tiny creatures that he couldn't name. The picture, so skillfully framed, showed two men surrounded by fairies. They were standing outside a village, with a crowd of ragged men behind them. One of the two was black, and had a bear by his side. The other wore a bird mask, and the knife in his hand was a bookbinder's knife. "The black hand and the white hand of justice, the prince and the blue jay." Balbulus looked at his work with barely concealed pride. "I'll probably have to make some changes. You're even taller than I thought, and you're bearing... But what am I talking about? I'm sure you're not anxious for this picture to resemble you too much. Although, of course, it's meant only for Violante's eyes. Our new governor will never see it, because luckily there's no reason for him to toil up all the stairs to my workshop. To the milksop's way of thinking, the value of a book is defined by the amount of wine it will buy. And if Violante doesn't hide it, well, he'll soon have exchanged it, like all the other books my hands have made, for wine or for a new silver-powdered wig. He can think himself truly lucky that I'm Balbulus the Illuminator, and not the Blue Jay, or I'd be making parchment of his perfumed skin." The hatred in Balbulus's voice was black as the night painted in his pictures, and for a moment, Mo saw in those expressionless eyes a flash of the fire that made the Illuminator such a master of his art. Footsteps resounded on the stairs, heavy and regular, footsteps of a kind that Mo had heard only too often in the Castle of Night. Soldiers' footsteps.
"What a pity. I really would have liked a longer chat."
Balbulus heaved a regretful sigh as the door was pushed open.
"But I'm afraid there are persons of much higher rank in this castle who want to talk to you."
Three soldiers took Mo between them. Fenolio watched in dismay as they tied his hands.
"You can go, Inkweaver," said Balbulus.
"But this is all a terrible misunderstanding."
Fenolio was trying really hard not to let his voice betray his fear, but even Mo wasn't deceived.
"Perhaps you shouldn't have described him in such detail in your songs," Balbulus observed wearily. "To the best of my knowledge, that's been his undoing once before. By way of contrast, look at my pictures. I always show him with his mask on."
Mo heard Fenolio still protesting as the soldiers pushed him down the stairs.
"Risa."
No, this time he didn't have time to fear for her. She was safe with Roxanne at the moment, and the strong man was with her. But what about Meggie? Had Farid taken her to Roxanne's farm yet? The Black Prince would look after both of them. He'd promised that often enough. And who knew? Perhaps they'd find their way back. Back to Eleanor, in the old house, crammed with books right up to the roof. Back to the world where flesh and blood wasn't made of letters. Mo tried not to think of where he would be by then. He knew just one thing. The Blue Jay and the Bookbinder would die the same death. Chapter 8. Roxanne's Pain. Risa often rode over to see Roxanne, although it was a long way, and the roads around Ombra grew more perilous with every passing day. But the strong man was a good bodyguard, and Mo let her go because he knew how many years she had lived in this world already, surviving even without him and the strong man. Risa and Roxanne had made friends tending the wounded together in the mine below Mount Adder, and their long journey through the Wayless Wood with a dead man had only deepened their friendship. Roxanne never asked why Risa had wept almost as much as she did on the night when Dustfinger struck his bargain with the white women. They had become friends not through talking, but by sharing experiences for which there were no words. It was Risa who had gone to Roxanne by night when she heard her sobbing under the trees far from the rest of the company. Risa, who had embraced and comforted her, although she knew there was no comfort for the other woman's sorrow. She did not tell Roxanne about the day when Mortola shot Mo, leaving her alone with the fear that she had lost him forever. Through all those many days and nights, when she sat in a dark cave cooling his hot, feverish brow, she had only imagined how it would feel never to see him again, never to touch him again, never to hear his voice again. But the fear of pain was quite different from pain itself. Mo was alive. He talked to her, slept at her side, put his arms around her. Whereas Dustfinger would never put his arms around Roxanne again, not in this life. Roxanne had nothing but memories left, and perhaps memories were sometimes worse than nothing. And she knew that Roxanne was feeling that pain for the second time. The first time, so the Black Prince had told Risa, the fire didn't even leave Roxanne her dead husband's body. Perhaps that was why she guarded Dustfinger's body so jealously. No one knew the place where she had taken him, to visit him when longing wouldn't let her sleep. It was when Mo's fever kept returning at night, and he was sleeping badly, that Risa first rode to Roxanne's farm. She herself had often had to gather plants when she was in Mortola's service, but only plants that killed. Roxanne had taught her to find their healing sisters. She told her which leaves were good for sleeplessness, which roots relieved the pain of an old wound, and that in this world it was wise to leave a dish of milk or an egg if you picked something from a tree, to please the wood elves living in it. Many of the plants were strange to Risa, with unfamiliar odors that made her dizzy. Others she had often seen in Eleanor's garden, without guessing what power lay hidden in their inconspicuous stems and leaves. The ink world had taught her to see her own world more clearly, and reminded her of something Mo had said long ago. "I think we should sometimes read stories where everything's different from our world. Don't you agree? There's nothing like it for teaching us to wonder why trees are green and not red, and why we have five fingers rather than six." Of course, Roxanne knew a remedy for Risa's sickness. She was just telling her what herbs would help the flow of her milk later on, when Fenolio, with Meggie and Farid, rode into the yard. Risa asked herself why the old man and her daughter wore such a guilty look on their faces. Of course, she didn't guess the reason. Roxanne put her arms around Risa, as Fenolio, his voice faltering, told them what had happened. But Risa didn't know what to feel. Fear? Despair? Anger? Yes, anger. That was what she felt first of all. She was angry with Mo for being so reckless. "How could you have let him go?" she snapped at Meggie, so sharply that the strong man jumped. The words were out before she could regret them. But her anger stayed with her, because Mo had gone to the castle even though he knew it was dangerous. And because he had done it behind her back. His daughter had been allowed to come with him, but to his wife he hadn't said a word. Roxanne stroked Risa's hair as she began to sob. Tears of rage, tears of fear. She was tired of feeling afraid. Afraid of knowing Roxanne's pain. Chapter 9. A Giveaway. A dungeon awaited him. What else? And then? Mo remembered the death that the Adderhead had promised him only too clearly. It could take days, many days and nights. The fearlessness that had been his constant companion over the last few weeks, the cold calm that hatred and the white women had implanted in him, they were gone, as if he had never felt them. Since meeting the white women, he no longer feared death itself. It seemed to him familiar, and at times even desirable. But dying was another matter, and so was imprisonment, which he feared almost more. He remembered only too well the despair waiting behind barred doors, and the silence where even your own breath was painfully loud, every thought a torment, and where every hour tempted you simply to beat your head against the wall until you no longer heard and felt anything. Mo had been unable to bear closed doors and windows since the days he had spent in the Tower of the Castle of Night. Meggie seemed to have shed the fear of confinement like a dragonfly shedding its skin, but Risa felt as he did. And whenever fear woke one of them, they could find sleep again only in each other's arms. Please, not a dungeon again. That was what made fighting so easy. Perhaps he could seize a sword from one of the soldiers in one of the dark corridors, far from the other guards on duty. For guards stood everywhere, with the milksop's emblem on their chests. He had to clench his fists to keep his fingers from putting that idea into practice. Not yet, Mortimer, he told himself. Another flight of steps, burning torches on both sides. Of course, they were leading him down into the depths of the castle. Dungeons always lay high above or far below. Risa had told him about the cells in the Castle of Night, so deep in the mountainside that she had often thought she wouldn't be able to breathe in them. They weren't pushing and hitting him yet, as the soldiers there had done. Would they be more civil when it came to torturing and quartering him, too? Down and down they went, step by step. One in front of him, two behind him, breathing on the back of his neck. Now, Mortimer, try it now. There are only three of them. Their faces were so young. Children's faces, beardless, frightened under their assumed ferocity. Since when had children been allowed to play soldiers? Always, he answered himself. They make the best soldiers because they still think they're immortal. Only three of them. But even if he killed them quickly, they would shout, bringing more men down on him. The stairs ended at a door. The soldier in front of him opened it. Now, what are you waiting for? Mo flexed his fingers, getting ready. His heart was beating a little faster, as if to set the pace for him. Blue Jay. The soldier turned to him, bowed, and left. There was a look of embarrassment on his face. In surprise, Mo scrutinized the other two. Admiration, fear, respect. The same mixture that he had met with so often, the result not of anything he had done himself, but of Fenolio's songs. Hesitantly, he went through the open doorway, and only then did he realize where they had brought him. The Vault of the Princes of Ombra. Mo had read about that too. Fenolio had found fine words for this place of the dead, words that sounded as if the old man dreamed of lying in such a vault himself some day. But in Fenolio's book, the most magnificent sarcophagus of all hadn't yet been there. Candles burned at Cosimo's feet, tall, honey-colored candles. Their perfume sweetened the air, and his stone image, lying on a bed of alabaster roses, was smiling as if in a happy dream. Beside the sarcophagus, very erect, as if to compensate for the lack of light, stood a young woman in black, her hair drawn severely back. The soldiers bowed their heads to her and murmured her name. Violante, the Adderhead's daughter. She was still known as Her Ugliness, although the birthmark that had earned her the name was only a faint shadow on her cheek now. It had begun to fade, people said, on the day when Cosimo came back from the dead, only to return there soon. Her Ugliness. What a nickname. How did she live with it? But Violante's subjects used it with affection. Rumor had it that she secretly had leftovers from the princely kitchen taken to the starving villages by night, and fed those in need in Ombra by selling silverware and horses from the princely stables, even when the milksop punished her for it by shutting her up in her rooms for days on end. She spoke up for those condemned to death, and taken off to the gallows, and for those who vanished into dungeons, even though no one listened to her. Violante was powerless in her own castle, as the Black Prince had told Mo often enough. Even her son didn't do as she told him, but the milksop was afraid of her all the same, for she was still his immortal brother-in-law's daughter. Why had they brought him to her, here in the place where her dead husband lay at rest? Did she want to earn the price put on the Blue Jay's head before the milksop could claim it? Does he have the scar? She didn't take her eyes off his face. One of the soldiers took an awkward step toward Mo, but he pushed up his sleeve just as the little girl had the night before. The scar left by the teeth of Buster's dogs long ago, in another life. Fenolio had made a story out of it, and sometimes Mo felt as if the old man had drawn the scar on his skin with his own hands, in pale ink. Violante came up to him. The heavy fabric of her dress trailed on the stone floor. She was really small, a good deal smaller than Meggie. When she put her hand to the embroidered pouch at her belt, Mo expected to see the beryl that Meggie had told him about, but Violante took out a pair of glasses. Ground glass lenses, a gold frame. Orpheus's glasses must have been the model for this pair. It couldn't have been easy to find a master capable of grinding such lenses.
Yes, indeed, the famous scar. A giveaway.
The glasses enlarged Violante's eyes. They were not like her father's.
So Balbulus was right. Do you know that my father has raised the price on your head yet again?
Mo hid the scar under his sleeve once more.
Yes, I heard about that.
But you came here to see Balbulus's pictures all the same. I like that. Obviously what the songs say about you is true. You don't know what fear is. Maybe you even love danger.
She looked him up and down as thoroughly as if she were comparing him with the man in the pictures. But when he returned her glance, she blushed. Whether out of embarrassment or anger because he ventured to look her in the face, Mo couldn't have said. She turned abruptly, went over to her husband's tomb, and ran her fingers over the stone roses as delicately as if she were trying to bring them to life.
I would have done exactly the same in your place. I've always thought we were like each other, ever since I heard the first song about you from the strolling players. This world breeds misfortune like a pond breeds midges. But it's possible to fight back. We both know that. I was already stealing gold from the taxes in the treasury before anyone sang those songs about you. For a new infirmary, a beggar's refuge, or somewhere for orphans to go, I just made sure that one of the administrators was suspected of stealing the gold. They all deserve to hang anyway.
How defiantly she tilted her chin as she turned back to him. Almost the way Meggie sometimes did. She seemed very old and very young at the same time. What was she planning? Would she hand him over to her father, to feed the poor with the price on his head? Or so that she could buy enough parchment and paints for Balbulus at last? Everyone knew that she had even pawned her wedding ring to buy him brushes. Well, what could be more suitable, thought Mo, a bookbinder's skin, sold for new books. One of the soldiers was still standing right behind him. The other two were guarding the door, obviously the only way out of the vault. Three. There were only three of them.
I know all the songs about you. I had them written down.
The eyes behind the lenses in her glasses were grey and curiously light, as if you could see that they weren't very strong. They certainly didn't resemble the Adderhead's lizard-like eyes. She must have inherited them from her mother. The book in which Death was held captive had been bound in the room where she and her ugly little daughter used to live after they fell into disfavor. Did Violante still remember that room? Surely she did.
The new songs aren't very good, she went on, but Balbulus makes up for that with his pictures. Now that my father's made the milksop lord of this castle, Balbulus usually works on them at night, and I keep the books with me so that they don't get sold like all the others. I read them. When the milksop is making merry in the great hall, I read them out loud, so that the words will drown out all that noise, the drunken bawling, the silly laughter. Tullio crying when they've been chasing him again. And every word fills my heart with hope, the hope that you will stand there in the hall some day with the Black Prince at your side and kill them all, one by one, while I stand beside you with my feet in their blood.
Violante's soldiers didn't move a muscle. They seemed to be used to hearing such words in their mistress's mouth. She took a step toward him.
I've had people searching for you ever since I heard from my father's men that you were in hiding on this side of the forest. I wanted to find you before they did, but you're good at staying out of sight. No doubt the fairies and brownies hide you, as the songs say, and the moss women heal your wounds.
Mo couldn't help it. He had to smile. For a moment, Violante's face had reminded him so much of Meggie's when she was telling one of her favorite stories.
"Why do you smile?"
Violante frowned, and for a moment he glimpsed the adderhead in her light eyes.
"Careful, Mortimer."
"Oh, I know, you're thinking she's only a woman, hardly more than a girl. She has no power, no husband, no soldiers. You're right. Most of my soldiers lie dead in the forest because my husband was in too much of a hurry to go to war against my father. But I'm not so stupid. Balbulus, I said, spread word that you're looking for a new bookbinder. Perhaps we'll find the Blue Jay that way. If what Taddeo said is true, he'll come just to see your pictures. And then, when he's in my castle, my prisoner, just as he was once a prisoner in the Castle of Night, I'll ask him to help me kill my immortal father."
Violante's lips smiled in amusement, as Mo looked sideways at her soldiers.
"Don't look so anxious. My soldiers are devoted to me. My father's men killed their brothers and fathers in the Wayless Wood."
"Your father won't be immortal for very much longer."
The words came from Mo's lips unthinkingly. He hadn't meant to speak them aloud.
"Idiot," he told himself. "Have you forgotten who this is facing you, just because something about her reminds you of your daughter?"
But Violante smiled.
"Then what my father's librarian told me is indeed true," she said, as softly as if the dead could overhear her. "When my father began feeling unwell, he thought at first that one of his maids had poisoned him."
"Mortola." Whenever Mo said her name, he pictured her raising her gun.
"You know her?"
Violante seemed as reluctant as he was to utter that name.
"My father had her tortured to make her say what poison she'd given him, and when she didn't confess, she was thrown into a dungeon under the Castle of Night. But she disappeared one day. I hope she's dead. They say she poisoned my mother."
Violante stroked the black fabric of her dress, as if she had been speaking of the quality of the silk and not her mother's death.
"Whether or not that's true, my father knows by now who's to blame for the way his flesh is rotting on his bones. Soon after your flight, Taddeo noticed that the book was beginning to smell strange, and the pages were swelling. The clasps concealed it for a while, which presumably was your intention, but now they can hardly hold the wooden covers together. Poor Taddeo almost died of fear when he saw the state the book was in. Apart from my father himself, he was the only one who was permitted to touch it, and who knew where it was hidden. He even knows the three words that would have to be written in it. My father would have killed anyone else for possessing that knowledge, but he trusts the old man more than anyone else in the world. Perhaps because Taddeo was his tutor for many years, and often protected him from my grandfather when he was a child. Who knows? Of course, Taddeo didn't tell my father what state the book was in. He'd have hung even his old tutor on the spot for bringing him such bad news. No, Taddeo secretly summoned every bookbinder between the Wayless Wood and the sea to the Castle of Night. And when none of them could help him, he took Balbulus's advice to bind a second book, looking just like the first, which he showed my father when he asked for it. But meanwhile, my father was feeling worse every day. Everyone knows about it by now. His breath stinks like stagnant pond water, and he's freezing, as if the white women's breath is already wrapping him in their deadly cold. What a revenge, Blue Jay. Endless life with endless suffering. That doesn't sound like the doing of an angel. More like the work of a very clever devil. Which of the two are you?
Mo didn't answer.
"Don't trust her,"
a voice inside him said. But his heart, strangely enough, told him something else.
As I said, it was a long time before my father suspected anyone but Mortola,
Violante went on.
His suspicions even made him forget his search for you. But a day came when one of the bookbinders Taddeo had summoned to his aid told him what was wrong with the book, presumably hoping to be rewarded with silver for the news. My father had him killed. After all, no one must know about the threat to his immortality.
But word soon spread.
Now there's hardly a bookbinder left alive in Argenta. Every one of them who couldn't cure the book went to the gallows. And Taddeo has been thrown into the dungeons under the Castle of Night. so that your flesh will rot away slowly like mine, my father's supposed to have said. I don't know if Taddeo is still alive. He's old, and the dungeons of the Castle of Night are enough to kill much younger men.
Mo felt sick, just as he had in the Castle of Night when he was binding the white book to save Risa, Meggie, and himself. Even then, he had guessed that he was buying their lives at the cost of many others. Poor, timid Taddeo. Mo saw him in his mind's eye, crouching in one of those windowless dungeons. And he saw the bookbinders. He saw them very clearly. Desolate figures, swaying back and forth, high in the air. He closed his eyes.
Well, imagine that. Just as it says in the songs, he heard Violante say. A heart more full of pity than any other beats in the blue jay's breast. You're really sorry that other people had to die for what you did. Don't be foolish. My father loves killing. If it hadn't been the bookbinders, he'd have hung someone else. And in the end it wasn't the bookbinder, but an alchemist who found a way to preserve the book. It's rumored to be a very unappetizing way, and it couldn't reverse the harm you'd already done, but at least the book isn't rotting any more. And my father is looking for you harder than ever, because he still thinks only you can lift the curse you hid so skillfully between the empty pages. Don't wait for him to find you. Steal a march on him. Ally yourself with me. You and I, Blue Jay, his daughter and the robber who has already tricked him once, we can be his downfall. Help me to kill him. Together we can do it easily.
How she was looking at him, expectant as a child who has just told her dearest wish. Come with me, Blue Jay. Let's kill my father. What does a man have to do to his daughter, wondered Mo, to make her want something like that?
Not all daughters love their fathers, Blue Jay, said Violante, as if she had read his thoughts, just as Meggie so often did. They say your daughter loves you dearly, and you love her. But my father will kill them, your daughter, your wife, everyone you love. And last of all, he'll kill you, too. He won't let you go on making him a laughingstock to his subjects. He'll find you, even if you go on hiding as cleverly as a fox in its den, because with every breath he draws, his own body reminds him of what you've done to him. Sunlight hurts his skin. His limbs are so bloated that he can't ride anymore. He even finds walking difficult. Day and night, he pictures what he wants to do to you and yours. He's made the piper write songs about your death. Such terrible songs that anyone who hears them can't sleep, or so they say. And soon he'll send the silver-nosed man to sing them here as well, and to hunt you down. The piper has been waiting a long time for that order, and he'll find you. His bait will be your pity for the poor. He'll kill so many of them that their blood will lure you out of the forest at last. But if I help you...
A voice interrupted Violante, a childish voice that was clearly used to getting a hearing from adults. It echoed down the endless stairway leading to the vault.
He's bound to be with her. You just wait and see.
How excited Jacopo sounded.
Balbulus is a very good liar, especially when he's lying for my mother. But when he does it, he plucks at his sleeves and looks even more pleased with himself than usual. My grandfather's taught me to notice that kind of thing.
The soldiers at the door looked inquiringly at their mistress, but Violante took no notice of them. She was listening to Jacopo outside the door, when another voice was heard, and Mo saw for the first time a trace of fear in her fearless eyes. He knew the voice himself, and his hand went to the knife at his belt. Sootbird sounded as if the fire that he played with so clumsily had singed his vocal cords. His voice is like a warning, Risa had once said of him, a warning to be on guard against his pretty face and the eternal smile on it.
What a clever lad you are, Jacopo.
Did the boy hear the sarcasm in his voice?
But why don't we go to your mother's rooms?
Because she wouldn't be stupid enough to have him taken there. My mother is clever, too. Much cleverer than any of you.
Violante went up to Mo and took his arm.
Put the knife away, she whispered. The Blue Jay won't die in this castle. I refuse to hear that song. Come with me.
She beckoned to the soldier standing behind Mo, a tall, broad-shouldered young man, who held his sword as if he hadn't used it very often, and made her purposeful way past the stone coffins, as if this wasn't the first time